Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Tommy Wood and today I am joined by my great friend Alex Ferretti. Hi Alex.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me. We've been planning to get you on the podcast for some time, so I'm really glad that I managed to make that happen. Anybody who exists in sports science field, maybe the low carb or keto field, has probably heard your name before. And you've actually made some pretty big name friends in the kind of world that we exist in. I know Rob Wolf loves your work, so does Ben Lynch. You've been collaborating with some great sports science researchers recently, like Dan Plews and Paul Larson, who we've had on the podcast previously. So maybe you could just start by just giving us a bit about your background, but then I'm really interested in hearing about how you developed relationships with those guys through your work.
Sure. First of all, I just wanted really to thank you guys for having me on the podcast. And I'm, you know, really do hope I'm worthy of it because your podcast is great. It's the one that I keep going back. I took a little time off now for personal reasons on work, but it's the one that I kind of look forward and, you know, great stuff. Really, really love the stuff that you guys do. When you mention all of the names that I've been doing some work or researching with, it's quite interesting because I don't ever stop and think about those things. I think things happen quite organically. So we kind of got in each other's world most of the times via social media or lectures and conference. Benjamin Lynch, for example, was in the UK doing a conference. I got there late. He had a stand and we started to chat. And it was really interesting because I said I was studying HIV, and with my accent and his ear, he thought HIV. And the problem is the conversation kind of got into 10 minutes before inquiry. Sorry, what are you researching again? The things didn't make quite a lot of sense. So I managed to get close to these people and look at their work primarily because of the type of work I was doing. And I started to be interested in metabolism and environment. So how the environment affects our physiology. I love looking how things happen. I think still an engineer kind of brain, and I love the test and retest, and if I do this, what happened, and why did that happen, and especially when it doesn't work, when you think this thing is going to work and it doesn't, this is when I get excited, not with patients. So that is what prompted me in trying to research metabolism, because as I mentioned a few times in podcasts, you know, I had a fasting glucose of 5.5, which is your 100, 102, 104 on organic food, no junk, exercising very actively as I always done, pretty gray lifestyle and eating little and often as I was taught, and things didn't quite work that way for me. Hence, I started to do this research and allow me to get working with these great people, really. So this is pretty much how it happened. So in the area that I naturally developed was mainly metabolism, which I studied very little at college. As far as this specific side of metabolism, we studied, you know, the nervous system and endocrine system, but not really fueling efficiency or metabolic flexibility, that kind of stuff. And then I started to experiment on people, guinea pig, the three Fs, as we call it here in England, the friends, fools, and family. And then extending it to a proper couple of three cohorts that I worked with and on more than with. So this is pretty much how it happened.
So you mentioned metabolic flexibility there. And I just interviewed Mike T. Nelson, who he talks about this a lot. I'm sure you know, and maybe this is a good chance to start talking about how you track metabolic flexibility or how you start to investigate whether somebody is metabolically flexible.
That's a brilliant question, which links in to one of the exchange that you, Waco, and I had some time ago. For people that don't know, Waco is a great guy that I wanted to work with because he had no previous training in nutrition, so completely free from any dogma. And how I got to work with Waco is because I gave him a bunch of data and told him, what's going on in here? Can you tell me what's happening in here? And he started to see patterns and, you know, pivot charts and all of that. And that confirmed what was happening. So as far as metabolic flexibility, this is, if I may finesse that, it's a jargon term that has been used in different ways. So I may tell you what I mean by that. And, you know, Mike's work is brilliant, by the way. I love his work. And I think it means something similar. But what I looked at as far as metabolic flexibility is the body's ability to efficiency fueling energy demand. So despite the type of substrate, obviously there is a little question mark on protein being so thermogenic and preferentially perhaps spared from energy supply unless it's strictly needed. So people could have a good energy supply with the minimum amount of substrate available coming from carbs and or fats or combination of both. And in essence, also the lack of chronic inflammatory response. What I've noticed is that in people that have active inflammatory response, there is a skew towards carbohydrate metabolism, which naturally seems to happen. I researched and found some brilliant papers, which I'll be very happy to share with you guys, of course, on certain size of the immune system and certain cells that only work via carbohydrate metabolism. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine some interesting scenarios in the keto community when people were trying to push that regimen and yet having inflammatory responses which were needed that were potentially inhibited by a ketogenic diet, where they reduced, where they stopped. So that is what I tend to consider for metabolic flexibility, if that makes any sense.
I guess there's a couple of parts of that. One thing, you may be saying that there's times when there's a carbohydrate demand in the body, particularly during an inflammatory process, that may be interfered with by going on a ketogenic diet. That might be why some people don't always see benefit from a ketogenic diet. Is that what you're saying?
That is my assumption from the observation I made, in the sense that, so the reason why I'm hesitating in stating that is because we cannot say A happens, B is there, B happens, therefore C, therefore A equals C, purely because the research is pretty clear in stating that in certain situations of immune system activation and challenge, there is a glycolytic pathway that is preferred. And some cells of the immune system only work through substrate as far as carbohydrate. Now, this does not mean that someone on a ketogenic diet cannot produce enough carbohydrate through breakdown of glycerol from fatty acids or by other means. What I'm interested in, and I was interested in, could this be a limiting factor for an inflammation to actually take place? Could the potential anti-inflammatory effect of a ketogenic diet, of some aspect of the ketogenic diet, interfere with recovery in athletic performance? And this seems, and I'm saying seems because my cohort was very, very small, that could potentially be the case.
This makes sense to me too, and I'll admit that my bias has been that there are some processes in the body that are dependent on carbohydrate metabolism or glycolysis or the pentose phosphate pathway. And there are certainly some people, particularly certain types of autoimmune disease, where people just don't respond well to a ketogenic diet. And my thought was always that that was part of the process. Yeah. But equally, when you take it through athletic performance, which is something that you and I are both very interested in, you know, when somebody goes on a very strict ketogenic diet, there's often a confusion between the number of carbohydrates that you can eat whilst training in a very high volume or high intensity and still be fat adapting or ketogenic or whatever you want to call it. You can actually consume quite a lot of carbohydrates and still achieve that depending on your volume and intensity. And actually the overt restriction or overly restricting them because you think it's going to be beneficial in terms of ketone production may well be detrimental. So it sounds like that's the kind of the thing that you've been starting to see.
That is correct. And what's really interesting is that when you mention ketogenic diet or a ketogenic state, that's the point that I always questioned, in the sense that what is a ketogenic approach? In the way how I say it, and please stop me if I'm going completely off my trolley here, but ketogenic diet, it's a diet, but that does not necessarily always reflect to a metabolic state.
Mm-hmm.
So some people with certain macro ratio have beta-hydroxybutyrate in blood. Some others have way more acetone measured from acetoacetate. So the ratio is different. So this is when people start to involve, you know, and point the fingers to electrolyte balance or niacin, riboside, and et cetera, et cetera. However, what I've noticed is that in the blood beta-hydroxybutyrate, the more flexible is the individual, especially going towards elite athletes, the lower it is, even when complying strictly to a ketogenic diet ratio.
So you're saying in elite level athletes, those who are the most metabolically healthy or metabolically flexible, it tends to be lower. Is that a different balance in terms of production, utilization, and wasting through the breath or the urine with acetone and acetoacetate? Or is it reflecting, say, the redox state of the liver, which changes the balance between beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate? Do you have some idea where those changes are coming from?
Yeah, this is where I'm not fully sure. The liver hypothesis has been quite interesting because it's something that I hadn't thought at the time. And that was brilliant, because it gave me a different insight. I suspected that the blood ketones at high levels were a buffer. Under normal physiology, our body will have ketones in a state of fasting. So anything that would mimic fasting will normally be considered by the body as a danger. And it would make a great deal of sense, although we have no proof, that the body will bump up the blood ketones in order to have a kind of a buffer availability, a certain reservoir that can quickly be shifted where the energy is needed. And this is when someone throw in the liver shift in production in order to feed the energy demand. In both cases, what is really interesting is that when people start, so we did a study that was not published out of six individuals, long distance events, so high volume events. And these were elite athletes, though. And their adaptation to a ketogenic diet was very, very quick.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when we started to research that the more efficient potentially mitochondria might be, the quicker is the adaptation. So some people that were pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic, I'm talking about, it took 6, 8, 10 weeks at time to start to actually, for them to start to feel great. I can't say it was the ketogenic diet, may have been other things, but as soon as we reintroduced carbs, the people felt dramatically better pretty much straight away. And then we did this, I did this especially with a few individuals, three times. So off, on, and off, on. And whereas with athletes, within in our study, the one that is not published, it took a literally less than a week. And that was quite impressive. And they had virtually no symptoms. That's the reason why I was skewing a bit towards that way. Is that making any sense?
So that makes sense. So then potentially adaptation to a ketogenic or low carbohydrate diet, and by adaptation you're largely going off subjective feelings, so just like whether somebody feels able to perform or feels like,
yeah, there were a few parameters, so RPE, so how they felt, their motivation to training, usual things like muscle soreness, breath ketones, blood ketones, and at the time also had a continuous glucose monitor sensor, which was the reliability on the trend. My assumption is that is good, but the reliability on the exact data, not so sure. So sometimes there was 1 millimolar, so 18 milligrams per deciliter difference. However, the trends is what we were interested, and then we spot checked at key points, if that makes any sense. So the error was quite constant, so either a calibration error or electrolyte influencing that subcutaneously. And what we've noticed is that after the first 3 to 4 days, so the first day was fine, second day most of them felt unease, third and fourth day were the worst, from the fifth day to the seventh day then people got better and better and better, and then after that people felt okay, as they normally would feel. Interestingly, a couple of them mentioned that their perception of the length of the recovery from the sessions was better, as in shorter, 2 unchanged, and 3 slightly longer. So it's a kind of 50-50 chance. So, yeah, I can't make any inferences on that.
I think the data in the published literature would agree with that. So I'm thinking of one study performed, which they did in New Zealand, looking at the ketogenic diet in some elite cyclists. And if you looked at, in terms of their performance metrics, some went up, some went down. And it was very different from person to person. I think there's always going to be some personal factor that we can't yet predict yet in terms of how people are going to respond to these kinds of interventions.
What I've done is starting to collect genetic data out of, this is going to sound ridiculous, as in 8 SNPs out of, what percentage is that then? So it's very limited, but these are involved in carbohydrate metabolism and tolerance, like NR3, CP1, ADBR2, ADBR3, and some of the others, and also fat metabolism. I have not had the means to check CPT 1 and 2 and CAT specifically, but that could potentially be, you know, a factor. So some people would do better given a certain genetic predisposition. Some other people would do better on another substrate given a different genetic predisposition. This seems to be confirmed in the N37 that I've done in my personal research project. I also had 7 individuals that had this test, the DNA fit test. It seems to correlate quite well, moderate correlation, so match for carbohydrate or fat sensitivity. This is what the test calls it. I did not have NR3C1, there's no P in that, and I did not have CAT and CPT 1 and 2. So these could potentially be quite important as far as utilizing long-chain fatty acid for energy. So anything longer than 12 carbon as far as length of the fatty acid has to use CPT 1 and 2 and CAT, and carnitine basically, carnitine transferase shuttle system. So could there be a limiting factor there? Potentially. That seems to potentially provide us some ideas on future research as far as application, on a more targeted application of a ketogenic type of approach.
Do you have any other thoughts on what environmental factors might be important? Because, I mean, we know that the eventual phenotype is an interaction between genotype and the environment, and the environment often plays a dominant role. I'm thinking about, you know, the diet fit study that just came out, which basically showed that whether people went on a low-carb or low-fat diet, at least with the current analysis that they published so far, there didn't really seem to be a genetic interaction when looking at people who might prefer a fat-dominant genotype or haplotype versus, you know, carbohydrate like the ones you're talking about. So what kind of environmental factors might be influencing that response?
Not specifically. I looked at more general environmental factors that made me realize a few things about ketogenic applications in relation. So for example, sometimes it's not what people eat, but is when and how much of it and how they eat it that could potentially skew the result of a certain diet. So for example, I'll give you a quick example that this is the typical people. So people are on a typical standard American diet or standard European diet. And then they decide to go into this trendy keto, intermittent fasting, cold immersion type of approach, just to name one. And they obtain results, which many times I have to say are great. The problem with that is that when I then started to look, for example, when someone starts to skip breakfast and try to go on a ketogenic diet, there are obviously benefits associated with the ketogenic diet or a low carbohydrate type of approach, but many times people were eating less because it's a more satiating diet. Mm-hmm. And they were also reducing naturally the eating window. So we have a few confounders which often had, in my observation, I can't speak for the whole world, but in my observation, in the people that I looked into, seemingly there was a hypoenergetic approach in concomitance to a low carbohydrate approach and other changes within lifestyle factors from the environment that could have contributed to an amelioration of their metabolic state. A euenergetic type of approach, things didn't really change that much. So what I've done, I took four individuals and put them on a really high carbohydrate diet, very low fat, a kind of Mediterranean type of approach, but made them follow the slightly restricted window. And what was really interesting is that the compliance was slightly harder. So seemingly the higher carbohydrates and lower fat were not as satiating, but despite the compliance potential for failure for people, the results were virtually identical. So we were taught pretty much only on the what, I think, from the environment interacting, leading to our phenotype. We also have to consider the when, the how, and obviously the how much. Now, the question is, if we go on a ketogenic diet, could the satiating factor be a winning factor for some people? Mm-hmm. And I think that holds some value in that. For athletes, definitely something to consider in long distance and high volume events, because many times I'm not sure if these people are eating enough across the board, and they are normally typical high carb diet consumers. But there could be some advantages in perhaps using in a kind of training low, competing high type of approach. One of the advantages that could bring. So this is the lifestyle environmental factor that I looked into. Another one would be sleep. Often people seem to report a worsening of the sleep on a ketogenic diet, mm-hmm. but mainly when people are skipping breakfast and, if I may say so, overcompensating with dinner. So I took other individuals, not many, and I said, okay, well, try to consume the same amount of calories, but on a high carb, low fat diet. And guess what? Disruptions were the same. Mm-hmm. So seemingly the worsening of sleep on a ketogenic diet seems to be related to the fact that many people skip breakfast.
And then consuming a large amount of food just before essentially going to sleep, or within an hour or two of going to sleep, which is, so then you're trying to digest at the same time that you want to be switching things off and recovering, which doesn't necessarily line up.
The main part, I think we may have discussed this a little while ago, Tommy, the sleep cycles are disrupted. So what was really interesting is that I measured these people pre-retiring glucose, and it was lower than the fasting glucose the following morning. Mm-hmm. So it cannot be because the body has not processed the meal, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So basically, the meal seems to affect the sleep quality, which the sleep quality seems to affect the actual fasting glucose the following day. Mm-hmm. And if people eat late enough, it will also affect heart rate variability snapshot reading in the morning.
And I think there's, particularly in people who have some kind of metabolic disease, so impaired fasting glucose or type 2 diabetes, that certainly seems to be the case, that when you have most of your calories late in the day or most of your carbohydrates late in the day, you then seem to get some carryover and a worse metabolic effects the next day, which sort of, you know, you're affecting sleep, you know, all of that stuff will sort of have a knock-on effect. If we go back and take a big picture, maybe you can tell us how you would assess a client, and we could potentially split these between people who have some kind of metabolic disease or a metabolic derangement versus an athlete. But how are you looking at their food intake, macronutrient balance, you know, you've kind of gotten to the point where you'd say a lot of things that I would agree with. So the timing is very important, and sort of the partitioning of macronutrients could mean maybe you know, if you're trying to improve metabolic health, you could go remove most of the carbohydrates, or you could remove most of the fats. And if you get everything else the same, you actually might see a very similar benefit. So how are you using all the information that you've collected to try and figure out what the best dietary approach might be for the person in front of you?
That's a great question. Interestingly, I'm writing a book on five main points. So the usual stuff, life load, so lifestyle, basically, so stress, what people call it. I call it life load because sometimes people don't consider that if they love doing something, that something is still a load. Mm-hmm. So doing my work, surely and clearly you guys do the same, yet it's still a load. So you're still investing energy, thought processes, cognitive ability, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Sleep, chronobiology, physical activity, that it's a good one. It was really interesting that monitoring my data, as long as you move, people actually get benefit. We can stay there and then finesse is HIT versus CrossFit versus endurance versus all sorts of different exercises. But as long as they move and are physically active, this is when we have a big jump in the correlation and then a drop off after that. So these are the main areas, and diet, of course, being a nutritionist, I should put that one, shall I? So the first thing I look nowadays in a person is actually a combination of chronobiology, sleep, stress, and diet. So I want to have a snapshot of their typical day, what they do, what they eat, but when they eat it and how they eat it. So many times people say, oh, you know, can you give me some digestive enzymes? I said, dude, you know, you're eating, walking, and on the phone. It cannot work like that. Mm-hmm. It might, but clearly it is not one of the best way for the body to digest food, but everyone would know that. But what I'm starting to see is a very clear picture that people are delaying breakfast and overcompensating later on in the day, especially people that are very challenged during the day. So they have a reasonably high life load. This could be, you know, involved by dopamine reward systems and all sorts of other things that can influence the amount of food and the type of food that people consume in the evening. There are two studies, one of them really elegant study, beautiful study on food preferences in relation to stress response and sleep deprivation. So keeping everything pretty much the same just by affecting the sleep quality and length, people would make different choices as mm-hmm. far as not only in the night, but also during the day. So my first approach is trying to assess, to have a snapshot of the life of the person. Then obviously work with the one that I would think would require the immediate attention. This obviously related to the symptoms. Mm-hmm. I asked them to gather a couple of weeks of continuous data. I have apps that will give me information and I can check remotely these people so I don't have to have constant calls or Excel or pages sheets sent through. And if they can, measure their glucose on top of their heart rate variability. Inevitably, in that specific subset population, and often in athletes, I find that the glucose is elevated.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, for an athlete to have 100 or 5.5 millimolar, so 100 milligram per deciliter and 5.5 millimolar fasting glucose, that's not great, really. Mm-hmm. So, and this is when then I started again on what potentially could be a chronic inflammatory response if it's present. Does it happen in the rest day? Do they have a rebound in a rest day? Often we call it rebound. So in the rest day, you see the glucose shooting up around 6. So, you know, 120, 118, that kind of levels. And if that's the case, then I think they're pushing, if they're aware that they're pushing the boundaries, fine. But if it's unjustified, then, so if that happens in a tapering phase, for example, we got a problem because mm-hmm. clearly the body's not recovering. In the other subset population, that could be slightly more stable, but still constantly elevated. So these are the first thing that I currently do, which is very, very different from what I was trying to do.
You mentioned apps that you're using. I know people listening to this are probably very interested in what apps you're using and what it is that you're asking your clients to track and how you might be able to follow that data remotely. Can you tell us about that?
I tend to use two HRV apps. If it's sports orientated, I use HRV4 training, where 4 is the number. So HRV4, the number, training, all one word, from Marco Altini and Alessandra Saviotti. The other one that is more, I use more for general population, is the Elite HRV from Jason Moore.
Yeah.
And both they have coach versions, and people can measure their HRV, takes between 60 and 120 seconds first thing in the morning. With one, you may need a sensor. I think with Elite HRV, you need either a strap or a Zoom HRV or whatever to take the reading. With HRV for training, can do it on the camera as long as you're keeping the hand still.
Mm-hmm.
So not, you know, jiggling around, which you should do anyhow when taking heart variability readings as a snapshot.
Yeah.
There are studies on the validity of ultra short, which are very consistent. So if people have the Oura Ring, I can use that, especially the data as far as chronobiology. I ask permission to them on accessing the cloud data, and then I can have a snapshot of that. I have checked the Oura data on HRV overnight, but that gives me a slightly different information from snapshot in the morning.
Okay.
So that tells me how hard the body has worked to get to the snapshot reading in the morning, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the ones that I use the most. And if they use HRV for training, they can have their personal tags, which are numerical. So they can put the fasting glucose and name it as such, and then I actually get to see that, and the app will naturally work out correlations between the two, which is pretty great.
Yeah, so this I guess is a good point to talk about the Ferretti Index, as I call it, which is a combination of fasting blood glucose and resting heart rate variability in the morning. Maybe you can tell us about that, like how it came to be, how you're using it.
Sure. It sounds very, very ominous to have my name attached to an index. I was researching the correlation between HIV and blood glucose. And the data I had, I found a correlation of 0.78, which is a decent one. And I thought, okay, great. Tying in with what we were mentioning earlier, I got really interested on what happened in when there isn't a correlation. So why there isn't a correlation? So HRV tells us the lack of parasympathetic status or presence, or reduced, or whatever that may be. So it's a measure of our central nervous system. So SNS versus PNS, and you know, heart health and et cetera, et cetera. Glucose is sensitive to inflammation. And I thought, okay, so when something happens, these two normally would actually move. So if there is a sympathetic activation, often there is an inflammatory response present as well. But what I've noticed, especially in athletes, is that athletes have a naturally higher heart rate variability.
Mm-hmm.
And their heart rate variability changes given their training, given their metabolism, are harder to detect if we look at population data. And they seem to be sensitive to glucose. So I started to do some digging and look at the literature that was available. And HRV seems to pick up the sympathetic nervous system dominance over PNS, parasympathetic nervous system. Glucose seems to pick up better inflammation, especially the chronic one, because it is enough to raise glucose, mainly thought to affect insulin sensitivity in cells. But these two at times may not go hand in hand. And that's the reason why I put together that factor, that index. Because I wanted to give more weight to the glucose, because this was my purpose, I put the glucose at the denominator and squared it. So it's something readable in a sense. And that has been, in my view, for our use, very insightful, especially with athletes, when changes of chronic inflammatory response, if justified, great, but if not justified and detected, can potentially save, especially as far as injury prevention or perhaps other states in which then the athlete would underperform. We also have population data for both. I remember Chris mentioning about the work of Dr. Walsh, mentioning that the all-cause mortality started to increase above 4.6, 4.7 millimolar equivalent of fasting glucose. And we have population data for heart rate variability.
Mm-hmm.
So we can still use the same index in order to actually check, although heart rate variability has a bigger standard deviation than glucose as far as optimal health. So some people have a naturally slightly lower heart rate variability. That does not necessarily mean that their health is affected negatively.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why I decided to combine these two to give a very quick, and also it's very simple. It's just a simple, you can do it, you know, on any phone calculator app very, very quickly, and gives you an idea that if the index is dropping, but the HRV is staying the same, there is something underlying there that can be detected 3-4 days prior a substantial drop in HRV. And that is the value in it.
So just to reiterate, you're taking the RMSSD and dividing it by the square of the blood glucose in millimolar. So if somebody is in the US and they're measuring in milligrams per deciliter, they divide that number by 18 and then square it and then divide their RMSSD by that. Can you tell us what's a good number for an athlete? And, I mean, are you able to do that? And this is probably something where, like most things, the absolute number tells you less than tracking the number over time. But then maybe if you see the number changing over time, so you said you could pick up stuff before you might see, you know, a significant decrease in HRV, but how, so then how might you intervene? Is that with diet, with training, with other things?
The absolute number is so variable that anything I'm going to say is going to freak people out that are in that bracket. What I can definitely tell you is this is the methodology that I ask people. So take, for example, in the general population, take their average rest day, so the average typical day, and measure it.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer 2 weeks of data, but with 1 week could be okay. And also some research has shown that if you take a reading every other day, it still actually works. So it still gives you a decent data set point that you can build a trend, you know, reasonably well, reasonably precise, reasonably correlating with what's actually happening. Then the square of the glucose, I use the square of the glucose because of the millimolar. People can use that system in whichever way they want. So at the end of the day is the concept. In fact, there is a paper that I think reasonably recently came out that they've done the same, but with CRP. The problem is that with CRP, you need a lab.
Yeah.
And to detect a trend with a lab is not that easy or not that practical, more than easy. It can be easy, but, you know, phlebotomy and et cetera, et cetera. So that's the reason why I took the fasting glucose, because it's still affected by inflammatory response. What I tend to observe is if something is justified. So a person following a heavy session at the gym, the following day, HRV is kind of reduced, okay, justified, carry on. We need to check tomorrow what that is like as he recovers, as you know. But I started to get a little bit more concerned when I see trends that are unjustified, especially when the glucose starts to raise, because normally that tends to correlate with the low-grade chronic type of inflammatory response, which is the much harder to see. If someone has a very heavy gym session, they are achy, they know they worked hard, the muscles are sore, you know, the motivation is a bit lower, etc. So fine, that's detectable, that's tangible in a way. But unfortunately, the type of inflammatory response that seems to be more affecting, so that the glucose is more sensitive to, is the one that is silent, that we don't actually see or feel. And that's the reason why I wanted to use glucose as a proxy, because that would give me an idea. So when I see the trends not justified, this is when I start to observe what numbers in specific, but taking in consideration the trend. So the number in relation to the trend, not the absolute number.
When you start to see this happen, what's your thought process for trying to figure out the potential causes?
The first question I ask myself is, what is changing these proxies? So it could be dietary, for example. Could be often is alcohol too close to bed, mm-hmm. in general population, not athletes. Sleep disruptions, going from, you know, newborn baby to workload to starting a new routine at the gym. So these are okay. That can be still reasonably justified, but obviously there has to be an intervention following the monitoring. I try to consider the 80-20 rule, if that makes sense. So what is the 20% investment that will give me the 80% of the return? Mm-hmm. You know, if someone has lots of vegetables, I'm not going to say, okay, from 6 pieces of broccoli, go to 9. That's not going to be the 80-20 rule. It may have improvements, but I'm trying to see what is the biggest shortfall that a person might have. And this is when I would look perhaps the not just the macro ratio, but the whole diet in general. So the produce and the amount of vegetables, the nutrient density, the whole thing. And also when they eat it. To me, it's quite important, because when people say, I eat at 8 o'clock, and then I ask, okay, what time do you retire? And what size of the meal? So it is a large meal because I skip breakfast and I retire at 10. So, well, 2 hours is nowhere near enough. When I took that cohort of 37 people, what I worked out is that what I have observed that if people retire on average was 11 o'clock, mm-hmm. between 6 and 8, I had to transform the data in categorical data because time is normally not. So I picked 2 hour slots. So 12, 14, 16, 18, and 2000 hours. So anyone that ate around 8 o'clock not only had the highest fasting glucose the following day, the highest chances of sleep disruption, and a decrease in heart rate variability. Whereas people that finished between 6 and 8 had the sweet spot, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. These were the people that HRV glucose was still not the lowest out of the whole of them, but it was still okay. The only person that didn't seem to make any difference is one that the glucose was constantly elevated anyhow. So I would call that outliers. So that would skew the data, but not for a good reason. So chronobiology, as mentioned, I looked at the sleep quality stress response. What was really interesting is that if I have HRV data on continuous monitoring data, so continuous HRV data like my first beat, for example, the Bodyguard 2 equipment, MovieSense, for example, even repetitive snapshots throughout the day at specific intervals and in specific situations. I mentioned, if I generate an average of that, then we can actually see the effect of the stress response, mm-hmm. which may not always correlate well with their perception, mm-hmm. which is rather interesting. These are the things that I look at first. Obviously, ameliorating the diet in the usual sense, look at nutrients, produce, is it fresh, is it good quality, organic, and whatever. How much in one sitting is the person eating? Are they eating little and often? Because it's great for some people, but definitely not great for others. I took a bunch of people, made them eat exactly the same quantity of food, but divided in 6 or 3. I wanted to really accent and enhance that difference. And out of that cohort, which were people with a tendency to type 2 diabetes, the people that ate smaller, more numerous meals was the one that had higher average glucose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe perhaps in that sense is not great. For athletes, made no difference whatsoever.
I'm now wondering if I can get you to speculate on some stuff that's, I guess it's talked about a lot in the keto community, maybe those who have a tendency to eschew eating all plants. It's fairly common that fasting blood glucose first thing in the morning will be pretty high, maybe even over 120. You know, we're into the sort of the 6 and 7+ millimolar, but that will be the highest blood glucose of the day. So it will actually continue to drop during the day. Do you see this as beneficial, pathological part of the adaptive response to somebody who's not eating any appreciable carbohydrate at all? If you saw that in somebody, are there things that you'd try and investigate to see whether there's something that could be improved there?
It's another great point you're making, as always, Tommy. It's, if it's part of the dawn phenomena and I have heart rate data for the period between 2 and 4 in the morning, then I can trace back either through adrenergic response in order to try to maintain the glucose or cortisol response. Either cases, the sleep is not great. So if someone says that the sleep isn't great and we find that the fasting glucose is elevated normally by, in my cases, I cannot speak for everyone, by tidying up the sleep, tidying up the eating habits, and tidying up perhaps the macro, tweaking the macro a little, that so far has been fine. So they lost that. If it persists, I don't feel comfortable in saying it's fine. That does not mean that is detrimental. I just don't think that if it's going on and on and on is a good adaptation process. If it happens prior exercise, just even the thought of exercising, the preparation, that will start to get neurotransmitters and hormones kicking left and right. And that, you know, we see that, we measure that. I measure that quite a few times in athletes, in myself, in other people. So when they get excited about something, we see variations in that. And what's really interesting is that we see variation in the HRV between 25 and 30 minutes prior to that. So when they had an ongoing measuring HRV system or device, I saw a drop in HRV and an increase in glucose offset by, let's say, half an hour to get a round figure. And that was really interesting. We see that in exercise, for example, but the most common scenario is eating too late.
Okay.
And you see the variation in heartbeat between 1:30 and 4, mainly around between 2 and 3. There is a big deviation, but that is when it seems to happen. And with an Australian scientist, we kind of speculated, well, if he is adrenergic, then beta blockers prior to bed should actually work by minimizing that effect. If he is then cortisol, then normally is associated with slightly different symptoms. So they kind of wake up and it disrupts you, but they don't tend to wake up in a fear or anxious state, like in an adrenergic response. So if he is cortisol, then we may be able to pick it up with the Dutch test, for example. You know, other tests, they are able to pick up a type of an incorrect daily patterns. The Dutch test also provides us some little information about melatonin, which is also useful in this case because we can see the relationship that there is between the two. An offset cortisol to us has always shown a higher fasting glucose the following day. So that makes perfect sense. That's the reason why my speculation is that if it happens occasionally, it's fine. But if it happens regularly, it could be an adaptation. But if it's an adaptation, should the person be on that? That's my speculation.
So I think everything that you've said makes a huge amount of sense. You know, the first part is kind of, it's a bit of the precautionary principle, right? So knowing what we do about elevated fasting blood glucose or elevated HbA1c and long-term health, you know, seeing those things in a given individual makes you at least wonder about what might be causing that. And there's a lot of data that you could generate in order to figure out whether that's potentially normal, physiological, or detrimental thing. So, you know, asking the questions, gathering the data that you need, rather than just essentially convincing yourself that it's not necessarily a bad thing, which is what most people are currently doing. They're saying, well, you know, my diet is great because I don't eat any carbs, therefore having an HbA1c of 7 or something is probably going to be fine. You know, that's, it's a bit of a jump there. There's more data that you can collect, and being cautious about that is probably a good idea.
Yeah, and the other thing I would want to do in that specific case is also measure homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
If the glucose is elevated, despite the HIV, and homocysteine is suboptimal, this is when I would not feel comfortable. Would not feel comfortable. And now homocysteine can be part of a cardiovascular panel, can be done by the doctor in just as a single test. And this is when I would be a lot more keen to intervene. Now, one thing that I would want to mention is that when we introduce a slightly higher amount of carbs, still considered pretty low carbs compared to average population, in most of these individuals, the glucose dropped.
Yeah.
So that makes me think, is it a natural process that the body is doing to try to pre-empty a dangerous situation in that the body perceives in the environment? Is it normal to have a slightly higher buffer? And we go back to my idea, thinking that ketones could be seen as buffer in the blood. So he's trying to pre-empty a situation. He's one of the biggest learning algorithm machines we ever own in our life, is our body, because he's constantly trying to predict things and trying to compensate. As soon as we have a routine, we adapt to the routine. So there are a few things to take in consideration. And my fasting glucose, I've been increasing my carbs due to the inflammatory response and, you know, my ops and the knee stuff and rehab I've been doing. And it has not shifted 0.1 millimolar. So from 4.3, it went up to 4.5. This yesterday, I did a heavier session. It's still 4.6.
Mm-hmm.
And I had yesterday nearly 200 grams of carbs as an estimate, but it was quite a lot more than what I normally would have. So that will go back to the index I use, that given the lack of inflammatory response, it doesn't seem that the macro ratio is as important, if that makes any sense.
I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I think the notion that carbohydrates in themselves are going to damage metabolic health in the absence of a whole host of other factors, you know, in quality and movement and environment and all that kind of stuff, I completely agree with your approach, and I think that makes perfect sense. We're sort of running out of time. There's so many different questions I had to ask you. But first thing, I know that you have relationships with some sports scientists. You're doing some more formal research. Are you planning to, or you may even already be doing it, to publish the effects of tracking the Ferretti Index, or whatever you end up calling it, so that it's sort of a formal thing that people can reference and use?
Yes. To put it simply, we slow down that side of things, and I'm looking to do that with Dr. Daniel Plues and Waco, obviously, purely because, especially in athletic performance, you can imagine if athlete can have a 2 to 3 day warning prior HIV drops on the setting of chronic inflammatory response, given that 78%, I remember it now, of the athletes' data set we have are in the pre-diabetic range, that can tell you a lot about it. So, yes, Daniel's structuring the study, and I'm going to fill it in with my thoughts and ideas. And I started to research more in depth interleukin 6, the classic and transsignaling pathway, when from anti-inflammatory becomes pro-inflammatory. I look at when insulin, being an anti-inflammatory hormones, when has an inflammatory effect.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all the things that I want to put in this paper in order to provide ideas to other researchers to perhaps take it further or better, you know, in whichever way. So yes, as soon as I finish my current project, is something that I really want to get stuck into.
Great. It sounds like it's going to be fairly comprehensive and in covering a lot of aspects that I find very interesting, like the, again, you know, insulin isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's often, you know, useful, and it's increased for a beneficial adaptation or to try and resolve some kind of issue that's ongoing. So you mentioned Waco again, and the final thing I was going to ask you about was the tool that you guys have put together, the Mitokinetics website, the tool. It allows you to put in your macros and your activity levels, and then it gives you some output based on, you know, what your expected ratios might be, or your respiratory quotient, or, you know, and how you might want to juggle your macros. Can you talk a little bit about, just briefly explain what the tool is, but then also how you might suggest somebody would use it?
First of all, thank you for mentioning it. I'm a sucker to self-promote things. First of all, it's free. It's on the web. We are testing now a mobile app that will be the usual something, not a lot, 99 kind of thing. But what we are aiming for is for practitioners. So it's not that we want to make $1 million on it, but we want to provide practitioners with a tool that, through refining the ratio of the macros in relation to the patient's condition or status, they can optimize the metabolic output in a nutshell. We found some pretty strong correlation between the respiratory quotient, the breathing rate, believe it or not, and the macro ratio inflammatory response. So we kind of put it all into one. And Waco had a good discussion with Dr. Kevin Hall, out of all people.
Yeah.
Very kindly, he pointed out that there might have been an error, which now has been rectified, within the calculation in relation to the potential output. So what we discovered is that when people are on a ketogenic diet or on a low carbohydrate diet and they become, let's say in jargon, more efficient in extracting energy from carbons, they may require less total energetic intake. But this is also true for people that fast a lot. So this is the reason why earlier I mentioned, do you remember the time, Tommy, when you mentioned to us, are you using the constraint model or the additive model in order to calculate? That was the biggest thing you could ever done to us, is in our understanding of metabolism, because that never really fitted with me and some of the patients I was following. So we decided to design a tool that takes in consideration, let's say, the number of carbons and how the body efficiently would extract energy from it, rather than just quantity of calories, which can be skewed if people go on dietary regimen like the ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if this makes any sense at all.
It does make sense. I think one of the main things that I remember from conversations with you guys about it was that point, which is that if you are trying to stay eucaloric or in caloric balance, if you're on a ketogenic or very low carbohydrate diet, that may require fewer calories than if you were eating a mixed or carbohydrate based diet, just due to the adaptations that occur. And I think that that's definitely something that needs to be taken into account when we're trying to compare diets calorie for calorie, because in reality that's actually a very unfair thing to do. And Kevin Hall is certainly involved in that process, and it's more complicated than I'm stating it right now, but, you know, that's certainly something that we need to take into consideration.
I still have people coming to me quoting, you know, I'm consuming 2,532 calories, should I take 1,550? And I said, dude, the error in caloric calculation through indirect calorimetry is in the double-digit figure region. So you making a change in the double-digit figure region, I'm hoping for you that that is not going to be a relevant change, because otherwise, metabolically, you are in trouble, in the sense that if such a subtle changes can bring a change, I don't think the change is in relation to a double-digit figure change in within the caloric input. So we're trying to measure something in a more relevant manner that can fit more diet. And that's the reason why we created that triangle, where given your goal, if it is losing body fat or increasing lean mass or maintenance, then people can start to skew the ratio accordingly to their goal and fix a caloric goal, which has been found to be not as precise Because otherwise, some athlete, especially long distance athlete, you could not explain how they're alive given the amount of calories they do not have. If that gives you an idea on that. So yeah, that's the reason why we designed that tool.
I think it's a great idea. I also think it's going to take some time for people to wrap their heads around it, just because you're essentially flipping the way that we should be thinking about these things on its head. And, you know, it just takes some time for people to wrap their minds around that. But I really hope that people go and try it out and play with it. And I know you guys always appreciate feedback from users. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And we could continue for hours, but I'm worried that we'll just overwhelm everybody. So maybe we can stop there and to be continued in the future. So in the meantime, can you tell us where people might go to find the things that you're talking about, to find out more about your work?
I have a very modest website. It's just myfullname.co.uk. So alessandroferretti.co.uk, that is. I haven't updated anything for a couple of months now, at least. But this is where I keep people updated on some of the podcasts or some of the stuff I'm researching and some of the observation I made. Or there is a video, for example, calories, are we measuring the right thing? Where I don't demean the calories, still great, but I just explain what, you know, some of the errors that people may need to take in consideration going into different type of dietary approaches. So people can search on my website, and then there is a link to Mitokinetics as well, with the app already in there. Yeah, that would be probably, I keep active, reasonably active on social medias, on, you know, sharing some, I don't know, interesting studies or some work from other people. This is where I normally am.
Okay, great. Well, I certainly enjoyed this a lot. I'm sure everybody listened to this enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for your time.
Very, very welcome. Still very honored to be here. So thank you guys for the opportunity to share my stuff.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.